Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For at least a generation, U.S. foreign policy has been driven by a belief that America can and should be the force for spreading democracy and free markets around the world.
The United States has a unique responsibility and a unique ability to be a force for peace and progress around the world while building coalitions.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements.
There's no right more fundamental than the ability to choose your leaders and determine your destiny.
Well, our guest today, Stephen Walt, calls that policy a failure. And he says, listen to what then-candidate Donald Trump said in the 2016 election.
In fact, as time went on, our foreign policy began to make less and less sense.
And Stephen Walt says, Donald Trump was right, but don't be fooled, Walt also says. The Trump administration may be headed down the exact same road of U.S. global social engineering. So Stephen Walt is calling for a total overhaul of U.S. foreign policy, starting with what he sees as an unaccountable foreign policy elite. This hour on Point, restraint, realignment, and realism, facing America's foreign policy failures. And you can join us, Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter. Do you agree with the notion that the U.S. has been driven by a misguided mission to spread democracy abroad? Do you think it's time to refocus how and where we project our power? Or do you fear that a more realistic U.S. foreign policy may open the door to unaccountable action from, say, Russia or China? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining me today in the studio is Stephen Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University, and his new book is titled The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Stephen Walt, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
So first of all, you call what you see as one of America's animating foreign policy forces as a liberal hegemony. That's kind of at the center of your book. What do you mean by liberal hegemony?
Well, it's a shorthand term for the grand strategy the United States has been following, say, since the end of the Cold War. It's liberal not in the sense of being left-wing or right versus right-wing, but liberal in the sense that it seeks to promote the classical liberal values of individual rights, democracy, free markets, things like that. And it's hegemony because it sees those things can only be spread around the world if they're done under American leadership, at America's behest, and through the active use of American power, in some cases, including the use of military power. So when you think about it, this is a strategy that doesn't seek to preserve the status quo. It actually wants to revise politics all over the world, make more countries like the United States, do that peacefully if possible, but if necessary, using other means as well. And that's basically been the objective of every American president since the end of the Cold War.
Okay, because as we heard in the introduction there, we heard President Bill Clinton, President George W. Bush, and President Barack Obama roughly saying thematically identical things. But so what's different starting in the post-Cold War era versus American foreign policy actions and goals prior to that?
Well, the United States has always stood to some degree for those ideals, and we certainly helped promote them after World War II in a number of different places. But I think the real change was the arrival of the so-called unipolar moment. The end of the Cold War leaves us without any peer competitor, no great power rival, in this remarkable position of power. And also this sense that with the Cold War victory, the wind is at our back, that democracy is spreading, markets are opening up in a variety of places, and therefore doing this, making over the world in America's image, is going to be relatively easy to do. We can do it at low cost. We can do it at low risk. So why not try? let's get really serious about social engineering in lots of different parts of the world simultaneously.
I see. So the supposed lower cost and lower risk following the fall of the Soviet Union is the primary difference. Because beforehand with a non-unipolar world, there was clearly articulated costs and consequences to trying to project American power around the world.
That's right. And it's not like the United States never made any mistakes, even in the Cold War, of which the Vietnam War would be probably the most obvious example. But after the Cold War ends, when the United States is really in this remarkable position, it's hard to argue against efforts to spread American values everywhere because it doesn't seem like it's going to cost much. Everybody thinks the world is already headed in that direction as well. You have people like Frank Fukuyama talking about the end of history. You have Tom Friedman of the New York Times suggesting that the American model is really the only one that can work in a globalized world, and therefore the rest of the world is just eager to become like us. It's really going to be quite easy to do.
Yeah. So I want to I'll explore with you more about what happened under Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. But just work with me here a little bit, because I still, as I was reading your book, a question I kept coming back to over and over again is perhaps there's a difference in terms of how the United States saw the ease with which it might be able to do this following the end of the Cold War. But again, it just never stopped the United States beforehand. I was thinking about all of U.S. actions in Central and South America in the 70s and 80s, or go back even further, and the overthrow of Iranian President Mossadegh in the 50s. I feel like this has always been kind of an animating impulse in U.S. foreign policy, the idea that U.S. values and ways of governing ought to be spread around the world.
Well, I think if you look at the Cold War cases, unfortunately, Central America, the United States was hardly on the side of democracy. We were perfectly happy to support dictators in Central America if they were anti-communist. And similarly, the overthrow of Mossadegh was democratically elected. It was a case of getting someone who was popular within Iran removed so we could have a tame client returning the Shah. In the context of the Cold War, in other words, the United States was quick to sort of shelve a lot of its democratic ideals when it felt it had national security imperatives or anti-communist imperatives. After the Cold War, once the unipolar moment arrives, there is, I think, this much greater sense that we can do lots of things in lots of places easily. We can expand NATO eastward and it won't cause any problems. We can start thinking about transforming the Middle East, as we ultimately do. We can take on new security obligations in the Middle East, in Europe, and in Asia. We can do that all simultaneously. And all of this is going to be sort of a virtuous cycle. Markets will spread. Democracies will be implanted. China will be brought into this new democratic fold. It will become democratic eventually, of course. And we're all going to live happily ever after in a truly wonderful world led by the benevolent United States.
Okay. So obviously a lot of people's thinking, or some people's thinking about that, has changed. And in the 2016 election, candidate Trump maybe articulated that better than anyone. We'll get to that in a minute. But I want to just remind folks sort of some of the rhetoric and language that we heard from previous presidents about this, about the United States being a democratizing force around the world. This is from 1995, the Freedom House breakfast. And then President Bill Clinton reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to world leadership, and he specifically spoke regarding American involvement in Bosnia, Haiti, and Mexico.
If the past 50 years have taught us anything, it is that the United States has a unique responsibility and a unique ability to be a force for peace and progress around the world while building coalitions of people that can work together in genuine partnership. But we can only succeed if we continue to lead.
So, Stephen Walt, President Clinton there saying that we can only succeed if the U.S. continues to lead. But he also talked about building coalitions as well. So what's wrong with that view of this liberal hegemony?
Well, there's nothing wrong with having partners. In some respects, there are issues where I think American leadership is quite valuable. But notice that this idea that nothing good happens without the United States being in charge really runs like a thread throughout this. And it never changes. You get to the Obama administration, I think in President Obama's last national security strategy, the word leadership appears on almost every page. It appears 35 or more times in the entire document. So there is this notion that Clinton expresses very well there, that we are responsible for all sorts of positive trends, that we have the right, the responsibility, and most importantly, the wisdom to do this. And notice also the assumption in there that if we're doing these things, we will find lots of ready partners. And of course, embedded in that is the idea that nobody really is going to object to this. And of course, one of the reasons the project of liberal hegemony failed is that some countries, countries that felt threatened by it, began to do things designed to make it fail.
What made the United States think it could be an exception to what a broad view of history teaches us? Because, and tell me if this analogy is too far off. But I was thinking as I was reading your book that, you know, the British for two centuries in their colonializing projects around the world, part of what they said they were doing was bringing civilization and British forms of government, governance and society to the places they were colonizing. That was part of their logic. Of course, resource extraction, et cetera, was also a really big part of it as well. But I think there's always been this notion that that powerful forces, when they spread that power across the world, are doing it for the good of the people that that they're going to.
Yeah, this is true of the French colonial project as well, and for that matter, the Soviet Union thought it was bringing socialism around the world. This is, great powers always have a sort of justifying story that they tell. We're also just a very liberal and very idealistic country. We believe strongly in our values, and I should make it clear, you know, I like democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, and for that matter, living in a market economy as much as anyone. I'm very glad that that's the way the United States is run. What I think all of these views miss, however, is that spreading your own ideals, no matter how much you like them, into other societies, societies that have very different histories, that have very different values, that are often divided along religious lines, along sectarian lines, and in particular, don't want to be told how to organize their own affairs by someone coming from abroad, no matter what their intentions are, that gets forgotten. And of course, that's one of the reasons this project has gone so badly.
Well, we're talking with Stephen Walt. His new book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. And when we come back, we'll talk about that foreign policy elite in much more detail. Do you think it's time for a refocus and a realignment of U.S. foreign policy that doesn't necessarily put spreading democracy at its core? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Stephen Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Let's listen to a little bit more about how multiple administrations over the past generation have talked about U.S. primacy being a reason why this country ought to spread democracy around the world. This is, first of all, you're going to hear from Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who, of course, served under President Bill Clinton. And she popularized the phrase indispensable nation to describe the United States. Here she is in 1998 during remarks she gave at Tennessee State University.
What is needed above all is American leadership. We are the only superpower, and as a result of that, we have many responsibilities and privileges, and we stand tall, and therefore we can see further into the future. And I think that therefore we do have a very special role.
Then in 2005, at his second inaugural address, President George W. Bush spelled out his vision for advancing freedom globally through American foreign policy.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
So, Stephen Walt, two different people from two different parties here espousing roughly the same idea, but you call this policy a failure.
Right.
Why?
Well, there's lots of different reasons. The easiest way to see this is look at the world we had in 1993, where we expected everything was going to go swimmingly, and the world we're in today. Back in 1993, the United States is on good terms with all the major powers, including Russia and China. Democracy is, in fact, spreading into Eastern Europe and in parts of Latin America. Iran has no nuclear enrichment capability at all in 1993. Iraq has been disarmed after the first Gulf War. The Oslo peace process is underway. So we're thinking that maybe we're going to get, you know, peace in the Middle East as well. There's extraordinary optimism there. Now, fast forward to 2018. The relationship with Russia and China is worse than it's been since the Cold War. There's been no progress towards peace in the Middle East. In fact, most people believe the two-state solution that the United States has actively promoted is farther away than ever. Iran had as many as 19,000 centrifuges before signing the nuclear deal, but they're essentially a latent nuclear power. And India, Pakistan, and North Korea have all tested nuclear weapons. Finally, democracy is in retreat in lots of different places. Freedom House reported last year that it was the 12th consecutive year of a decline in global freedom. So when you have President Bush saying that that's our goal, right, to end tyranny in the world, that goal doesn't seem to be working out. One final point. The Economist magazine last year in its democracy index downgraded the United States from being a full democracy to a flawed democracy. So it seems to me if the project here was to spread American values far and wide, that project has failed, and with quite significant geopolitical consequences for us, as well as the costs we've seen in a variety of different places.
Without a doubt. But are you saying that, for example, the retreat of democracy worldwide that American foreign policy efforts can be seen as having contributed to that retreat?
I think they've contributed. They're not the sole cause as well. But for example, I think we pushed democracy very quickly into places in Eastern Europe. And what we're seeing now, the backsliding in Hungary, backsliding in Poland, suggests that that project has not gone particularly well. Certainly, American efforts to transform the Middle East at the point of a rifle barrel, in fact, have clearly failed. Had the United States not invaded Iraq in 2003, you would not have gotten ISIS. The effort to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi led to a failed state, and other American interventions in places like Somalia and Yemen have made things worse rather than better. And by the way, while all of this is going on, then countries like Russia and China and Iran and North Korea and others sit there and say, well, the American objective is to overthrow other governments and turn them into democracies. We're not really a full democracy, so we have to be worried about that. So what can we do to prevent that from happening to us? Well, one reaction is you seize Crimea to stop Ukraine from moving towards the West. Another possibility is you get nuclear weapons, because then the United States will have to leave you alone and might even be willing to meet and talk with you as well. So in a sense, the project, which is an admirable one in terms of its ideals, tends to generate a backlash in a variety of places.
So one of the questions that you explore in the book, the key question is how this notion of the primacy of the U.S. project to spread democracy persisted for so long. Because, I mean, we went through some of the examples, but it was an unimpeachable part of U.S. foreign policy for so long. You couldn't even question this as one of the duties that America had to the world, being this guiding light for democracy. But you say that there's an entrenched foreign policy elite that helped that idea, that notion persist across administrations. Who are they? Who is this foreign policy elite you're talking about?
Well, it's a broad group of a set of people. I would say, you know, when Ben Rhodes, the former national security advisor, referred to the foreign policy blob in Washington, that's essentially who I'm talking about. But we're talking about the formal institutions of government, the parts of the actual government and bureaucracy, the Defense Department, Intelligence Services, State Department. So they're part of this. The whole sort of think tank world, the penumbra of supporting institutions in Washington that write and comment on foreign issues on a pretty much daily basis. Then, of course, we have various special interest groups and lobbies on a whole series of issues, from arms control to human rights to ethnic lobbies to the business community as well. I would put in parts of the media who write about foreign affairs and, of course, people like me in academia who are also actively engaged in writing, who train students and often go to Washington to work. So that's who I'm talking about. And what's striking to me about most of that group, not every single member of it, but most of that group, is the remarkable consensus behind what I've called liberal hegemony, this idea that the United States, first of all, has to exercise global leadership in every corner of the world. And second, it has to do that in the pursuit of the spreading of these various liberal ideals. And there's a whole – I could talk about the different sort of sacred cows within there, but there is remarkable consensus across party lines in favor of that. You see this in the fact that most Democrats supported the Iraq War back in 2003. You see that in the fact that people can circulate amongst different think tanks without much difference because they're all kind of interchangeable to some degree. And finally, I think you see that in the fact that the various quotations you've been playing here from Republicans and Democrats alike all subscribe to the same set of ideals.
But so I want to get to him in a second about how you see this foreign policy elite as unaccountable. But Iraq is the disaster of the Iraq War is an interesting moment to discuss here because I just want to dive into that a little bit. Because, you know, you said that the majority of Democrats supported the Iraq War. But wasn't that in part because it was also sold to the American people as a war for the security, national security of the United States? I mean, that's part of what you say here, that the foreign policy elite has frequently co-opted issues of security in order to get people on board with this idea of spreading democracy. I mean, isn't the Iraq War the perfect example of that?
I think it shows you how easy it is to steer the debate. And one of the points I make in the book is that the foreign policy elite, and especially presidents in the executive branch, have all sorts of advantages in selling policies to the world. And I point out that there's actually a pretty significant gap between what the American people actually say they want. They want a more restrained foreign policy. They don't want to engage in all these crusades around the world. So how do you convince them to go along? Well, you do the things that the Bush administration did, but again, it's not unique to the Bush administration. You inflate threats. You pretend enemies are 10 feet tall and have to be dealt with immediately. You exaggerate the benefits. So, you know, by doing Iraq, by doing Libya, lots of good things are going to come of all of this. You try to conceal the costs. So you use an all-volunteer force so you don't have to draft anybody. And you don't raise taxes to pay for any of these adventures. All sorts of things designed to make sure that the American people don't really notice in any visceral or visible way what's happening. And then finally, this community tends to be a rather self-protective one. So you don't hold people accountable for failures. And it doesn't matter sort of how many times you may screw up as a practitioner of foreign policy in the United States. It's really hard to sort of lose a position within that elite.
Yeah. So on this issue of accountability, people aren't losing their jobs when they lead the United States into misguided foreign policy adventures, if I could put it in a slightly flipped tone. But also – Does the fact that I don't know how many of them do or don't have family members that are in the United States military, does that make a difference? Because, I mean, if they're not immediately feeling the life or death consequences of some of the policies they're supporting, Shouldn't that matter?
It should. I don't think that's the thing that determines this. I think you could find members of the foreign policy establishment or the foreign policy elite who've been in favor of very adventurous policies who also had family members or in some cases themselves had served as well. So I don't think that's the critical thing. You know, having more sons and daughters in the military would substantially alter this. The chapter that talks about accountability, sort of runs through different segments of the elite and uses a variety of examples to point out that there just doesn't seem to be much accountability. For example, I used the example of Paul Wolfowitz, who was one of the architects of the Iraq War, advocated for it in the Bush administration, helped mismanage the war. And of course, at the end of the first Bush term, when he decides to leave the Pentagon, President Bush, despite this clear record of failure, appoints him to be president of the World Bank. He goes to the World Bank. He's there for a couple of years. He eventually has to resign amid various ethical accusations of misconduct. And of course, lands at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington, and gets appointed to the State Department's International Security Advisory Board. So, you know, here's a decade of bad judgment and no apparent professional consequences for it. And of course, one can multiply examples like that many times over.
Well, that may be one of the reasons why on our website we have this comment coming in from MJ Demena, who says, "We have a government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich, and it's imperial. We have no problem. I have no problem," MJ Demena says, "with foreign intervention if it's to stop a genocide, no matter the cost. But America intervenes to make money for millionaires and billionaires and for the rich." Stephen Walt, we got a lot of callers, so let me bring some of them in here. Jackie is calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, Jackie.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
No problem. What's your thought?
Sorry, I'm a big thinker. So I'll start with a caveat that, or the preface that I know America's made mistakes in foreign policy. One, being a Democrat, I did not agree with the Iraq War. And then, of course, you know, I've been studying Vietnam, and that is a whole other thing. But I really feel like that we need to be in charge of sort of not this whole liberal thinking, but of the idea of liberty. And I do believe in coalitions. I don't think we have to have a foot in every part of the world. But like the comment had said about genocides and stuff like that, or it's like the fact what Russia's doing, obviously that there, you know, are a lot of discrepancies and different things going with Putin, you know, and Syria. Syria is something that is, we're watching something getting blasted off the face of the earth, you know. And I understand, like, that there is a sense of want to isolation of isolationism, but we watched that happen in World War II, and we have seen that happen in World War I. And I feel like that it just sort of makes us feel a little bit safe for a little bit of a while, and then we watch these other players get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well,
and
Jackie, if I may, I've got to take it back from you there before we head into a break, but thank you for your call. Stephen Walt, your response to Jackie, because I think what I hear her saying is that she's concerned that if the United States does have a more realistic or realist foreign policy, as you say in the book, that that does leave the door open for the rise and greater influence of powers like Russia and China, which she doesn't necessarily think we can trust.
Yeah, it's a very valid concern. The title of the book, "The Hell of Good Intentions," I think captures my views on this. That we've done a variety of things with often good intentions that haven't worked out particularly well. And one of the things we need to think about is, you know, why that is the case. For example, the idea that the United States should intervene anywhere to prevent genocide. I think that in some circumstances that would be true, but you have to ask yourself: are we likely to make things worse or make things better? And at what cost are we going to do that? So, for example, there was a genuine debate over what to do about Syria. And I think President Obama made the judgment that deeper American involvement, and by the way, we were involved in Syria, but deeper American involvement would only make things worse as well. So I think one has to start with a clear sense of what American interests are, a very realistic sense of what American power can and cannot accomplish. Remember, we're only 5% of the world's population. And certainly, nothing in my book argues for isolationism. In fact, it argues for considerable American engagement in a number of places, but not quite the way we've been doing it for the past quarter century.
But It has been argued in the past that American interests were served by, say, the dozens of military bases we have around the world. I mean, the President Trump, you know, has said that he doesn't think the United States should be paying for the protection of allies anymore. But on the other hand, I think in the past it has been said U.S. military presence on or near allies' soil helps protect them, which then, A, keeps the United States safer, but also, you know, free markets are a part of this, too, that in a sense they're protecting the global economy that the U.S. relies and profits from.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's not a very convincing case that you need to have an American military base all over the world in order to have a global economy. We've had global economies before, and it's not like if the United States adjusted didn't eliminate, but adjusted its military posture, countries would immediately stop trading with each other and stop trading with us. So, I mean, that argument gets made, but I don't think it's particularly convincing. The other point to make to the caller and in response to your comment is that the United States has not always been a stabilizing force. Mm-hmm. You can argue that we were a stabilizing force in Europe during the Cold War. I think we have been, for the most part, a stabilizing force in parts of Asia, with some exceptions. We have not been a stabilizing force in the Middle East, I think, certainly at any time in the last 25 years. So this idea that American leadership keeps the peace and therefore keeps the world economy going just doesn't stand up to much scrutiny.
Well, we are talking with Stephen Walt. He's professor of international affairs at Harvard University, and his new book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We've got an excerpt of it, by the way, at onpointradio.org. And we want to know what you think. Do you think it's time for a realignment of U.S. foreign policy? Do you agree with President Trump when he said that as a candidate? But do you see him following through when it comes to him as a president and his administration? And we'll talk about what Syria and the issue of Syria might show us in terms of the difficulty with following through with that promise. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking today with Stephen Walt. His new book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. And Professor Walt, lots of comments coming in. Let me just read a couple of them to you. On Twitter, Paul Muth is saying, question the premise that the U.S. was ever really on a humanitarian intervention, military or otherwise. It says Noam Chomsky debunks this, and Walt should counter his arguments. Our limits of allowable debate are showing. David Crandall says liberal hegemony. Missing from our discussion is the counterfact that liberal values of human rights, etc., have been used as a stalking horse for American corporate hegemony, which is a highly questionable democratizing influence. Just your thoughts on those two comments, first of all, Stephen Walt.
I'm sort of sympathetic to both comments. I've never thought that American foreign policy was heavily driven. I want to be very careful here. Heavily driven by corporate interests in this sort of narrow sense. Yes, the United States has favored a globalized economy, and that's good for some corporations, not all. And in some cases, there have been corporations that had particular influence over U.S. foreign policy. But I don't think that's what we do. We do a lot of things that actually don't benefit corporations at all. If you go back to the 1990s, for example, Dick Cheney, when he was running Halliburton, used to complain about our sanctions-happy foreign policy because it was making it impossible for Halliburton, an oil services corporation, to do business with Iraq or to do business with Iran. Cheney wanted to make money, but our foreign policy was one of sanctioning both of those countries.
And then that very same person was vice president during the Iraq War, and Halliburton got to go in and and have billions of dollars of U.S. contracts there.
That's right. Then finally, I think the United States does not devote a lot of effort to purely humanitarian interventions. It's hard to get the United States to do something purely to help other people. I'm not talking about rescue missions and things like that. But I do think that motivation has been there. That has driven certainly the intervention in Libya was, I think, driven in good part by the desire to prevent what people suspected would be, if not a genocide, at least mass killings in Benghazi, and the desire to end that. Now, at that point, then the sort of desire also to try and do regime change took over, and what had originally been justified by purely humanitarian concerns and approved by the UN Security Council on that basis became something bigger.
Yeah. But so just to follow up on this idea of corporate interests, when we're talking about the foreign policy elite in Washington, though, aren't some of those corporations the funding sources for many of the think tanks we were just talking about in the previous segment?
Yeah, no question. And if you look, I think, at the role of the military, what Eisenhower calls the military-industrial complex, they are very actively involved in funding a variety of think tanks and organizations who, not surprisingly, then want the United States to have an ambitious foreign policy and a very strong military because that's where they make their money.
Yeah. All right. Well, lots of callers here, so let's at least get a couple of them in here. Mitch is calling from Cumming, Georgia. You're on the air, Mitch.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. You know, I just think under our current president, who's an amoral agent, mostly concerned with wealth, I worry that our American values are going to be malleable, that they might even be for sale. I think the current controversy around Saudi Arabia and journalists highlight this conflict of interest, and I just want to know your thoughts. Are our values for sale?
Mitch, thank you for your call. Stephen Walt.
Well, in some respects, I think our values have always been to some degree for sale, or there have always been a sense of trade-offs. There were a set of ideals that the United States has stood for and wanted to promote in the world, and there were other imperatives as well, whether national security or others. And we have always sort of wrestled with which of these to favor. And most of the time, it's sort of national security and economic prosperity that tends to win out most of the time. We are seeing a particularly stark vision of that right now with the controversy over the possible murder of the Saudi journalist Khashoggi in Istanbul. And it's interesting to see that you know, for example, there's supposedly this big conference in Saudi Arabia next week, and a bunch of corporate sponsors and other participants have been pulling out of it. President Trump has been waffling, it seems to me, on this one, that his initial statements were quite forgiving. He seems to be, in typical Trumpian fashion, kicking up a sort of squid ink cloud of distortion about it. So I think, you know, the concern the caller has is exactly right here. And that's, I think, one of the larger issues with President Trump is his inability to separate out some of his own personal interests and possibly personal financial interests from the broader interests of the country.
Well, so let's talk more about the Trump administration now, because you open your book saying that then-candidate Donald Trump had a clear articulation of his view of these foreign policy failures that we've been talking about throughout this hour, Stephen Walt. So let's just remind folks what the president or then-candidate Trump said when he critiqued the status quo of U.S. foreign policy. Here he is on the campaign trail from April 2016.
Unfortunately, after the Cold War, our foreign policy veered badly off course. We failed to develop a new vision for a new time. In fact, as time went on, our foreign policy began to make less and less sense. Logic was replaced with foolishness and arrogance, which led to one foreign policy disaster after another. They just kept coming and coming.
That's Donald Trump on April 2016. Now, Stephen Walt, we could talk a lot about the foreign policy decisions the president has made since then. I mean, about the Paris Climate Accord, about his discussions with North Korea, about the Iran nuclear program. But I really want to focus on Syria here for a moment, because, you know, we just heard the president in 2016 saying lots of foreign policy disasters led by foolishness and arrogance. But now we're hearing, for example, National Security Advisor John Bolton talking about expanding the American mission in Syria beyond the Syrian civil war and to containment of Iran for as long as Iranian forces are in Syria or Iranian-backed militias are anywhere in the region. So here's National Security Advisor Bolton again issuing a stern warning to Iran at a group called the United Against a Nuclear Iran Summit last month.
If you cross us, our allies, or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat, and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay.
So John Bolton there, Stephen Walt, not necessarily talking about a democratizing force, but an expansion of the U.S. military mission in Syria. So is the Trump administration being pulled by the same foreign policy forces that we've been talking about this hour?
I think in the 2016 campaign, Trump, who's not a sophisticated thinker on these things, but he did intuit that something had gone badly wrong with U.S. foreign policy. And that resonated with the American people when he said, you know, American foreign policy is a complete and total disaster. A lot of people nodded their heads in agreement. And that was especially effective against Hillary because she could tout or tried to tout her foreign policy credentials. But I think what you've seen is since Trump became president, although his style, his approach to the presidency and his public style of handling diplomacy, whether it's by Twitter or by his personal interactions with other leaders, is completely different and I think remarkably counterproductive. What strikes me most about it is how he has been pulled back in a lot of these same directions. Certainly the fact that having complained about nation building, we're going to get out of the nation building business. You know, he sent more troops to Afghanistan. As you recounted, he now seems to be willing to commit the United States to stay in Syria much longer, even though we don't really have an idea of what we're trying to accomplish.
I mean, potentially there. Indefinitely.
Potentially indefinitely. He has bought hook, line, and sinker the idea that Iran is some mortal threat to American interests throughout the Middle East. And that, of course, has led him to double down with Saudi Arabia, double down with Egypt, double down with Israel as well. But notice that those are all of our traditional Middle East allies, so he's not doing anything different there. You'll recall he was very critical of NATO. Said NATO countries had to start spending more. They had actually started spending more even in the Obama administration. But of course, he has now reaffirmed the American commitment to NATO in a variety of ways as well. And finally, just as the Obama administration was pivoting to Asia and getting more concerned about China, the other central theme of the Trump administration has been confronting China much more aggressively. They're not doing it very effectively, in part because, for example, he left the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was designed to help strengthen our position in Asia. But in a lot of respects, if you look beyond the style, the central elements of American foreign policy under Donald Trump are not, in fact, radically different from that of his predecessors.
I mean, is it because so many of the same people are there?
Well,
John Bolton, we have General Mattis at DOD. I mean, these are not unfamiliar names.
No, that's exactly right. And when Trump became president, he didn't have a well-developed group of people he could put into key positions who would then articulate and implement a somewhat different foreign policy.
Okay. So we're going to get to what you think we ought to do about this in just a second. But let me let another caller in here. Marianne is calling from Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Marianne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to say that under the past administration, there was a lot of pushback. And the former president was unable to get a lot of policy through because the Republicans are obstructionist. Just my opinion. Getting back to the president currently, he's been flip-flopping all over the place where foreign policy is concerned because I don't believe that he knows what he is doing. He has no proper agenda, and it's kind of like a fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants. Like, you know, whoever likes me better is going to get something from me, or I'm going to, you know, play along with this person, and it's not a game. I mean, they're playing around with people's lives, like in Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, we should not even be in the Middle East.
Right.
We should have been out of the Middle East a long time ago.
Marianne, let me just take it back from you there. And Stephen Walt, Marianne there was talking about how she sees inconsistencies in President Trump's foreign policy. You made a similar point just a minute or two ago. But I want to spend the last couple of minutes of this conversation talking about your prescription of what to do about this, because it is important to underscore that this idea of America as a democratizing force has been something that's been championed by administrations of both parties. So, and if this foreign policy elite, as you're talking about, is so entrenched in Washington, how do we change this? And what is the new American posture you'd like to see?
Marianne's question gets right at this, because if you think about it, Obama faced the same problem. He wanted to shift American foreign policy, but had to do it with an establishment that didn't want to move either.
And he left troops in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The last four presidents all ran for president arguing for a more restrained foreign policy. Obama, or rather Clinton, said, you know, it's the economy, stupid. Bush said it was going to be a humble foreign policy. Obama runs saying he's going to do less. Trump runs. And they all end up doing a very ambitious foreign policy. So in terms of spreading our ideals, the thing we should do is set a good example. If the United States is working well, if American democracy is functional, if American society is more equal, if our roads, bridges, airports, subways are gleaming and modern, then other countries will look at the United States and say, I'd like something like that. I'd like to be more like them. That's not us taking this abroad and insisting that people become like us. It's presenting a model that others will want to emulate. Now, how to do that? Well, I think you have to break I don't want to say stranglehold, but the power of this bipartisan consensus that sees liberal hegemony and American global leadership in a very sort of undifferentiated and unselective way as the only game in town, the only way to think about our foreign policy. And that, I think, will require, in a sense, creating, if not an entirely new foreign policy elite, at least a much broader one.
How do we do that, though? Because these are not elected folks. We can't rely on elections to bring in new thinking and new blood. I mean, a lot of these people are not even – they're not even in appointed posts. They're just influencers, but very powerful influencers.
Right. First of all, there's no guarantee this will happen, but I think it has to, in a sense, begin like many political changes begin sort of from the grassroots or from the outside. You're going to need to get people who are willing to fund this. You're going to have donors who are willing to support organizations and think tanks with a different view of American foreign policy. You're going to have to try and have jobs for people who come through graduate school and want to do foreign policy but have a different vision of what that foreign policy ought to be, and they have to have a career path that they can then follow. There are some groups that are trying to do that. Now, the one model you might think of is it's a model on the right, is the Federalist Society. Federalist Society set out 25, 30 years ago to remake the American legal system based on a set of conservative principles. They had funding from various conservative groups as well. And I would argue they've had a considerable success. It's not like they've taken over the judiciary, but they've really moved the needle in a substantial series of ways. And I think you have to think in similar terms here, that you're not going to change the American foreign policy elite by next Tuesday. You might be able to change it by 2030, 2035, 2040. And by the way, I think this is going to happen because the nature of the world is changing as well. The United States is not as dominant as it once was. The United States is going to have to be more selective, not isolationist, but more selective about where it engages, what it commits to, and what its objectives are.
But you still have that momentum of the power of a self-preserving elite, though. And I have to say, I think we've had many members of that elite on this program who would return again and again to the point that if the United States does not lead in the way that it historically thinks it has, that it does leave the door open, we heard a caller say it earlier, to potential bad actors such as Russia and China. And that is a risk that they would say the U.S. can't afford to take.
Well, first of all, the record that I document in my book suggests that having the United States be in charge everywhere hasn't worked out particularly well. We've screwed up a lot of things. Secondly, having the United States be the linchpin to every foreign policy problem, that we've got to be the answer, in a sense, asks too much of us. We would have have a more stable world if we devolved more of those responsibilities onto others, worked constructively with them instead of insisting that we could do it all.
And you're calling that offshore balancing.
I am.
All right. Well, if you want to know about what offshore balancing means, I suggest that you take a look at it because Stephen Walt writes about it extensively in his remarkable new book. It's called The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard University as well. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Nice talking with you, too.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.